there is Buddhism and Science. They actually gave a title for the talk. And as soon as I got that title, I thought, that's a good one for this evening, because about a month ago, I think, I was invited to the West Perth Observatory as part of the Centenary of Federation celebrations in WA. The youth groups were organising all the events. And one of the things they wanted to organise was an event called Our Place in Space. But even though that was the title of the event, the meaning of the event was to try and find out whether the future would be a future which followed science or would follow religion. To see how those two so-called contradictory approaches to life would pan out into the future. And so there was a couple of religious representatives. I was representing the Buddhists. There was a teacher from St. Hilda's School representing the Christians. There was Jamie Biggs, a state astronomer, and there was another PhD candidate from UWA, about to get a PhD in physics, who was representing the physicists. What they didn't know, of course, was that before I was a monk, I was a theoretical physicist. So I knew what they knew, and I knew what Buddhists knew as well. So it was a bit unfair, but I had really good fun there. And it was good fun, actually, talking in front of the audience about Buddhism and religion and science, and how they come together, the dangers in religion and science, and how that they can be used to help people live their life, find a way through their lives in a wise, compassionate, effective way. So this evening I'll talk about Buddhism and science. And I started off, because there's a few kids there, telling them some things which many people just do not know. Because Buddhism is such a wide subject, and there's still many things in the West which people don't know about that great religion. Especially from the old suttas, the old scriptures. Do you know who the first person in space was? Who was the first man in space? No. Certainly wasn't Yuri Gagarin. At least it was a Venerable Rohitasa. Because I think you all know that if you really get your meditation together, you can levitate. Now, a long time ago, this is in the suttas, this is in one of the stories. There's no reason to disbelieve it, because it was a hermit who, living alone in the jungles, in the forest, developed his meditation and learned how to rise into the air and fly. Now, this particular hermit, he wasn't just an ordinary levitator. He was a very skillful, one of the best levitators that have ever been, because he decided that he could go so fast, they said faster than an arrow, he decided to try and find out where the universe ends. So one day he decided, off he went. And he went for many, many, many years. Could never find beyond solar systems, into deep space, using the power of the mind to be able to do this. And sometimes people say, that's just belief, that's just not real fact. And later on I'll mention a few facts which show that could and probably was real and possible. The thing was, he went, they say, for many, many tens of years and died on the way, never finding an end to the universe. And being reborn in one of the heavenly realms, he went up to the Buddha and actually told his story. In a previous life, as a hermit, he'd been levitating and went forever and ever and ever and died on the journey. First, monkonaut, not cosmonaut, astronaut, hermitnaut, whatever you call it, and died on the journey. And that's where the Buddha actually said to him, you stupid hermit, that's not where you find the end of the universe. The end of the universe can be found within you. Same as the beginning of the universe. He was the astronaut. What it actually was showing was an answer to one of the questions which So often people ask of Buddhists, well, who do Buddhists believe created this universe? They're asking a scientific question, the origin of this universe. And because of the fact that Buddhism is founded on meditation, and that meditation can reveal many, many things, especially deep memories of the past, the monks, nuns, ordinary meditators, they can get to such great meditation that not only levitate, but they can remember previous lives. And many people can actually do that. As I've mentioned here, if ever you have a very deep meditation, you're very, very peaceful, very deep inside, very still. And when you come out afterwards, if it is a deep meditation, have incredible energy afterwards. You won't be able to go to sleep. You won't be able to just go and watch the TV, because the mind will just be full of its own joy and happiness. Very still. It's also, when it's so empowered, you can make suggestions to it. Suggestions which it would not normally be able to follow, but empowered by deep meditation, it does follow it. And you ask yourself for your earliest memory. What's my earliest memory? I've taught this to people, especially on meditation retreats, because on meditation retreats, a lot of people, you know, every now and again, get some deep results. What's your earliest memory? And they get memories of times when they were, first of all, babies. Then they may get memories in their womb. And if they're lucky, they get memories when they were a very old person. Memories of the past. One of the important things with those past life memories is that they are very real to you. It's as if you're back there experiencing it. And anyone who's had a memory like that, there's no doubt in their mind. It's not a maybe anymore. That was them. In the same way you remember where you were this morning, where you had breakfast. You've got no doubts that that was you this morning having that breakfast. You didn't imagine it. With the same clarity or even greater clarity, you remember that was you. Only it wasn't just a few hours ago. It was many decades ago. A different time, a different body, a different life. Now, if you can imagine that people can do that on 9-day meditation retreats, imagine what you do if you're like a monk or a nun who meditates not just for a weekend or for 9 days, 9 years, 29, 39, 59 years. Imagine just how much power you can build up in that meditation. Imagine if you're a Buddha, the power of that type of mind. That's why the Buddha said he did remember past lives, many past lives, many eons of past lives. Said specifically, he remembered 91 eons. That's 90 Big Bangs. Time before and time afterwards. Huge spaces of time. And that's why that when he said about not just one universe, but many universes, we're not talking about parallel universes like some scientists say, we're talking about sequential universes. Always beginning with what they call sangwati and vivati. This is part of, say, the unfolding of the universe and the infolding of it, beginnings and ends. They even give a measure of the time for a universe. Because I was a theoretical physicist, because my areas of expertise were the very small and the very large. I liked fundamental particle physics and also astrophysics. Those are the two parts which I like the most, the big and the small. And so I knew actually what they meant by the age of a universe and what a Big Bang was all about. And the age of a universe is somewhere around, the last time I I looked in the journals, was somewhere around 17,000 million years. Sometimes it changes to about 10 or 13 or 18, but somewhere in that order. In the Buddhist suttas, they say about 37,000 million years is a complete age. So 17 or 13 or 20. When I told that to Jamie Biggs, a state astronomer, he said, yeah, that's in the ballpark. Jamie Biggs, a state astronomer, he said, that's acceptable. What certainly isn't acceptable is the person who was actually convening that was Verity James. And she made a joke about that in 100, 200 years ago, Christianity said it was only about 7,000 years old, which is completely out of the picture. But what we're actually saying there is that there is a cosmology in Buddhism 25 centuries ago, which you don't have any problem at all with modern physics, even to the point of what they say as world systems, galaxies. You know, the word they use for galaxies is wheels. Wheel systems, they call them. This is Pali. And if any of you have ever seen a galaxy, there's actually two types of galaxies. A spiral galaxy, which is Milky Way is one of those. You've seen a little spiral, like a wheel. And the other one is the globular clusters, which is more like a wheel with a big hub in the middle. But wheels is a very good way of describing galaxies. And this was by someone 25 centuries ago who did not have telescopes. They didn't need them, they could go there themselves. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in the old suttas. Even for those of you who like weird stuff, sometimes people ask, they actually ask this question at that meeting. Do Buddhists believe in extraterrestrial beings, in aliens? Would that really, suppose there was like an alien landed over here, would that really upset the very foundation of Buddhism? And actually, that when I was reading through these old suttas, 25 centuries, I actually found one in there. It's only a very small, not an alien, but a sutta which said that there are other world systems with other beings on them, with other suns, other planets, and other beings on them. That's directly in the Anguttara Nikaya. I'll find it for you if you're ever interested in that. On that occasion at the West Perth Observatory, one of the people at question time, they put their hand up and they said, why is it, they said, that when I look through a telescope, I feel that my religion is challenged. It was a Catholic Christian who was a very honest lady who was saying that she felt scared when she looked through a telescope, because what she was seeing out there as fact sometimes did not meet with what she was told in her books. As a Buddhist, you don't need to be afraid. But I take that question and I turned it back onto the scientist. I say, what if you get on the opposite end of the telescope and have a look at who's looking? You scientists, I think you'd be scared, afraid, if you turn the telescope inwards and looked into yourself and say, who was looking at all of this? Because part of the problem with science is it is all out there. It's always a metaphor of a person looking through the telescope, looking into the apparatus, but never reflecting back to see who's actually looking at all of this. Who's doing this? Life. Because it was getting a bit dull, I really stirred up Jamie Biggs when I started to talk about life. Because any scientists here, you all know that through something like quantum mechanics, quantum theory, they have these wave functions, but somehow when observation, when life, when experience gets involved, it collapses the wave function. It gives it reality. an experience, a real thing. And there has to be an observation, a life in there to make it happen. In the same way, I remember reading in one of the journals, I don't know how long ago, there's one of the fundamental laws of physics called the second law of thermodynamics. The entropy always increases. In other words, we get more chaotic. But there was one fellow, I don't know his name, I forgot his name, who won the Nobel Prize for showing that the exception is when it's a closed system and there's life. And that turns around the second law of thermodynamics and we get organization rather than disorganization because of life. And I was having this lovely argument, which really stirred people up because it was getting a bit boring. You know, I like arguments sometimes. It gets people going. With Jamie Biggs. That the universe is a closed system. And it's got life in it. That's where there is organization. So life, observation, is what they called in physics when I was at university, the ghost in the machine. The ghost in the machine, which actually messes up all the theories. This is why I was saying that what we take as science in the universities, in the labs, in the hospitals, it often suffers the same which I would criticize religion for, dogmatism. You know what dogmatism is like in religion? When we have a belief, and whether it fits with experience or not, whether it's useful or not, whether it's conducive to people's happiness, harmony, peace in the world or not, we follow it just because, well, that's my belief. Just following beliefs blindly, dogmatically, is just a recipe for violence, for suffering, for everything. One of the beautiful things about Buddhism, which encouraged me to be a Buddhist when I was young, and which keeps me as a Buddhist, was that questioning was always encouraged. And you did not need to believe. Even to the point that, in one of the tales from the time of the Buddha was giving a teaching to his chief monk, Venerable Sariputta. And this was one of those stories which is central to the very ideals behind Buddhism. And after giving this teaching, he turned round to his chief monk, this famous, wise, second in charge, basically, and said, Sariputta, do you believe what I said? And Sariputta, without any hesitation, said, no, I don't believe it, because I haven't experienced it yet. And the Buddha said, well done, well done. That is the attitude which I want to encourage in all my disciples. Not just believe it, but to keep the open mind until you've experienced it. Now that goes against that dogmatism, that fundamentalism, which you don't just see in religions, but you see that in science as well. The eminence of a great scientist, as the old saying goes, their eminence is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. The more famous they are, the more prominent they are, the more their views and ideas are taken to be gospel truth, the more they stop other people challenging them and putting forth a better truth. The way of Buddhism is if you find a better truth, use it. There is this old story in the time of the Buddha, about these two people who went looking for some sort of goods or treasure in a town which had been abandoned. And they found, this is an old story straight from the books, they found some old hemp. And so they decided to make a bundle of that hemp and carry it away because they could sell it when they got back. So the two of them make a big bundle of hemp. And then they came across some hemp and cloth. One of the guys said, you know, what do I need the hemp for? Hemp and cloth is better. And the other guy said, no, this is already well bound up. I've carried this for so long already. I'll keep my old lump of hemp. And then they found some flax. And then they found some cotton. Then they found some cotton cloth. All the time, the guy who was carrying the hemp said, "No, it's already okay for me." Then they found some silver, and then they found some gold. And each time, one of the guys would always change what he had on his head for something better. But the other guy kept his old bundle of hemp. And when they got home, they said the guy who had carried the gold, he said, was very popular with his family. And the guy who carried the hemp did not please either himself, his family, or anybody. It was a simile which the Buddha gave of why don't we change our views, our ideas, when we see something better. You know why we don't do that? Because it's called attachment. It's called self. This is my view. We don't really want to change. We feel comfortable with the old views even though we know they are wrong. Sometimes our image is bound up with those views. Like a scientist is bound up with their achievements, what they've seen so far. And this is the problem called dogmatism. Sometimes when I say about levitation, some people say, well, that doesn't exist. That's just theory. Wait till you see someone. Even if you saw someone levitate, even if the three monks here were just raised up about 2 or 3 feet, wouldn't that be good? Sorry, we can't do that in public. It's against our rules. Even if we did, it would be terrible if we did. It's one of the reasons why we can't do these psychic powers in front of people. If we did, we've already got this movie over here. Someone will probably sell it to Channel 7. And then you get everybody, even from overseas, coming to Perth, not to listen to the Dhamma, not to listen to Buddhism, but just to see the monks do their tricks. And then you get into all sorts of problems with having to demonstrate it every time. The point being here is that that's not what monks are there for, to demonstrate tricks. But, you know, suppose you did do it. A lot of people say this is just a trick, just like special effects. They're not really levitating. If you don't want to believe it, you won't. This is the problem again with dogmatism. What you don't want to see, you just cannot see. You don't want to believe it. In denial. This is why that I was really charging. A lot of scientists are in denial about the truth of the mind. And you've all heard me say before here, that, and I mentioned this in this seminar over here, because this is one of the easiest, well-known, or should be well-known, cases which really challenge modern science. It's the old case of Professor John Lauber, Sheffield University, and the boy with no brain. And if any of you want to check that out, click onto your internet, Professor John Lauber. See if you can actually find it there, because this is real. Professor John Lauber was a scientist in Sheffield University, whose area of expertise, his area of study, his speciality, was the shape, the anatomy of the human skull. And he would do a lot of research on people whose skull shape was slightly out of the ordinary. And whenever he was walking the corridors of the campus, if ever he saw any student whose head was slightly deformed, he would actually offer them a few pounds, a beer money, to be able to join in the experiments. And one day he came across a young student whose skull shape was slightly deformed. No other person would ever notice this, but he was the expert. And when he invited this student onto the research program, the first thing he did to the student was to give him a CAT scan, a CT scan, of his head. And there he found this boy had no brain. But he was an honors student in mathematics at Sheffield University. And he became the famous boy with no brain. And this is not just a fabrication. That CAT scan has been done again. They found other people with no brains, especially At this time, they were saying, during the First World War, when there was such carnage in the trenches of Europe, when people had their skulls literally blown apart by bullets and shrapnel, the doctors there found that many of those corpses, with their heads shattered, were empty. There was no brain there. The evidence of those doctors was put aside as being too difficult to understand. But this Professor Lorber, he went forward with his findings and published them, to the great disturbance of the scientific community. You know how many billions of dollars are going into the research on the brain? And how that the chemical imbalances in the brain and the synapses are causing your depressions or your lack of intelligence or your emotional this or your emotional that. And here is one clear piece of evidence to show you don't need a brain to have a mind. For those of you who are more technically minded, a doctor friend in Sydney explained it more accurately to me once. He said he'd seen that CT scan. It's well known in the medical community, he said. He did his training in Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. He told me that what that boy had is called a reptilian brain stem. And he explained that usually any baby born with just a reptilian brain stem without the cortex and the other stuff will usually die straight away or just a few days, weeks after birth. It's only just enough, most times not enough, to keep the basic bodily functions of breathing, heart, liver and stuff going. But he said it's certainly not enough to keep the higher brain functions going. It's certainly not enough for speech, not enough for intelligence, certainly not enough for being an honors student in mathematics. And this doctor told me, he said, Ajahn Brahm, you wouldn't believe the problem that is causing in that part of science, because it's shattering so much research, because it is challenging so many drugs which making their makers, their producers, billions of dollars in profits, because people can't really understand how it is a person without a brain can be intelligent. He said that they're just putting it in the back of the filing cabinet as an anomaly. But it won't go away. The dogmatism of science says as soon as you start to put in this mind, this ghost in the machine, the scientists get fundamentalist and dogmatic and say, no, that doesn't exist. This is why I really took Mr. Biggs to task about the dogmatism of science. As far as Buddhism is concerned, there are six senses, not just the five senses. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. From the very beginning, mind has been the sixth sense. 25 centuries ago, six senses were always there. And that sixth sense from 25 centuries ago, this is not just changing things to keep up with science. This was there from the very beginning. That sixth sense, the mind, is independent of the other five senses. In particular, that mind is independent of the brain. That's why, if you volunteer for a brain transplant with me, you take my brain, I'll take your brain. I will still be Ajahn Brahm, and you will still be you. Want to try it? If it was possible, it would happen. You'll still be you. The reason why is the mind and the brain are two different things. The mind can use the brain, but doesn't have to. Today I was giving a funeral service this afternoon. You all heard of out-of-the-body experiences. These out-of-the-body experiences have been put on a solid scientific foundation. That's why I said this is a It's a scientific fact how the body experiences. I like to stir people up by saying that. That's a scientific fact how the body experiences exists. Recently I saw a researcher from Southampton University Medical School presented a paper in the US stating that consciousness survives death. He said, don't know why it happens, how it happens, but he says it does. And his evidence were people who had out-of-the-body experiences in his hospital when they died on the operating table. One of the things which they found out, one of the scientific facts is to have those out-of-body experiences, you have to be dead. Only those people who had medically died floated out of their body. And this fellow in Southampton University, I forget his name, he investigated, interviewed many, many patients, and the information which they gave him, as a cool-headed scientist, said, yeah, those people were conscious during the time they were dead. Especially what was very convincing was that they could actually describe to the doctor the medical procedures which were done at the time they were dead. They could describe it as if they were looking at their body from a position above the table. He said, how that happens, he can't explain. Why it happens, can't explain, but the evidence proved to this hard-nosed doctor, it does happen. He was repeating some work done by Dr. Raymond Moody in the United States earlier. How could that happen? How it happens if we agree that the mind has nothing really much to do with the body. Brain doesn't need to be there to have a mind. The scientific facts are there. The evidence is there. But a lot of scientists don't like to admit those facts. They don't like to draw the obvious conclusions because of dogmatism. If you had one person who was medically dead, who could describe what was being said, who could describe what was happening to them, to the doctors, as soon as they came out of anaesthetic, wouldn't that be pretty convincing? You know, when I was doing elementary particle physics, there was one theory which required for its proof the existence of what was called a W particle. And the cyclotron or synchrotron or something in Geneva, they did a huge research project bashing atoms together, one of these big atom smashers, to try and find one of these W particles. They spent literally hundreds of millions of pounds on this project. And they found one, just one. I don't think they've found one since. And once they found one W particle, the people involved in that project all got Nobel Prizes for physics. They'd proved this theory by just finding the one W particle. And that's good science. Just one is enough to prove. But when it comes to things we don't like to believe, just one experience, one clear, factual, undeniable experience, they call anomaly. Now, anomaly is a word in science for something you can put in the back of a filing cabinet and not look at it again. It's just because it's changing our worldview, changing what we want to believe, threatening our dogma. But the point is that evidence is there. And if one admits that evidence, if one has a scientific method, the scientific method is that the theories have to be abandoned in favor of the evidence, the facts. And that theories, what we call sacred cows in the West, have to be abandoned. If you see something which challenges every theory in science, you have to not just ignore the facts, you have to change the theories. That's also in Buddhism. All the Dhamma of the Buddha, everything he taught, if it does not fit experience, you should not take on the Buddha's words in contradiction of experience. That's Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha said, do not believe just because it's said in a book, so even if I say it, don't just believe because it's tradition, or because it sounds good, or because it's comforting to you. Make sure it fits your experience. The existence of life, of mind, if you look carefully, fits experience. The facts are there. However, sometimes that in this age we cannot trust the experts. You cannot trust Ajahn Brahm. You cannot trust the scientific journals because people are biased sometimes. Buddhism gives you that scientific method for yourself. It says you can do the experiment and find out if what the Buddha said was true or not. Check out your experience. For example, the experiment, the method to test out the truth of past lives, rebirth, reincarnation. He said, don't believe it. Find out for yourself. And he gave a scientific experiment, what you should do. You know what you should do to find out if you had a past life? Meditate. I don't mean just meditating just to make yourself calm and get rid of stress. I mean really meditate, deeply meditate. Get your mind into what we call the jhanas, the deep states of absorption where the body has disappeared. You don't feel, you can't see, you can't hear. Absolutely inside the mind. No thoughts, but perfectly aware, blissed out. If you get into one of those jhanas, and the method, the instructions for the experiment are very clearly laid down. Even in my little book, The Basic Method of Meditation, all the steps are there. If you follow them, and if you invest the resources necessary for doing that experiment, it doesn't not only just one weekend retreat, many weekend retreats, many years sometimes of meditating. If you want to follow that scientific method, after you've gone into a jhana and you emerge afterwards, if then you ask yourself, my earliest memory, you can go back and you will remember. And you will see for yourself the experience of past lives. Then you will know, yeah, it's true, because you have seen an experience for yourself. If you want to understand the law of karma, which is part of Buddhism, karma, is that just a theory? Or should you believe there's a God up there who decides whether you're happy or whether you're unhappy? Was it just chance? Everything which happens to you, your bare happiness or suffering in life, your joy, your pain, disappointments, is that deserved? Have you done that? Or is it someone else's fault? Or is it just chance? You know, whether we're rich or whether we're poor, whether we're sick, whether we live to an old age or a young age or whatever. Why? You can find that out for yourself. Experience the law of karma, again, through that deep meditation. When the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya, those were the two knowledges, they say, he got before full enlightenment. The experience of the truth of rebirth. The experience of what karma is all about. Not theory, not thinking, not something you discuss around a coffee table, but deep experience. And also, the experience of the nature of mind. All the religions in the world start talking about a soul, except Buddhism, a self, an essence of all being, a person, a me. And this is one of the deepest of questions to answer. The ghost in the machine. What is that ghost? Is it a soul? Is it a being? What is it? When the Buddha said there's no one in there, he never meant that to be believed. He meant that to be experienced. He said this is a scientific fact. There's no one inside of you. But, like any scientific fact, it has to be re-experienced, each one for themselves. Pachatang Vedittobo Vinyuhi. Many of you chanted that in the puja just before I came in. Basic, fundamental, scientific Buddhism to be experienced each person for themselves. You keep an open mind. You don't believe there's no self. You don't believe there is a self. Both are dogmatism. Well, you take that open mind and you do the experiment. The experiment of Sila Samadhi Panya. Virtue, meditation, insight. Basic Buddhism. Do the fundamental experiment which the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. Repeat it and see if you get the same results. The result is called enlightenment. Many men and women have repeated that experiment over the centuries. That's where we get the enlightened arahats from. They're ones who've done the experiment and found the result. That's why the Buddhism always has been a scientific way of finding out for yourself the truth of these things. On the way to enlightenment, which might feel a long way for you, there's also the scientific way of finding out what most people are interested in. Happiness. What is happiness? A little party trick for you. A little trick which is very wonderful to demonstrate to people the existence of the mind. We had some students from the Islamic school came to my monastery on Thursday. I was trying to teach them some Buddhism. I asked them, "Are you happy? Put your hands up if you're happy now." "Oh, you're all miserable. One person, that's all. Come on. Are you happy?" Okay, all those people who put their hands up saying they're happy, with your index finger, can you now please point to their happiness? Can you point to their happiness? Can you give it coordinates in space? That's science. Hard, isn't it, to locate happiness? Even when you're depressed. Have you ever been depressed? Next time you're depressed, with your index finger, point to it. Where is it? You know why you cannot locate depression or happiness? You cannot give it coordinates? Because these things reside in the mind. Not in the body. Not in space. In the mind. And the mind is not located in space. That's why, after a person dies, they become a ghost. Ghosts can appear all over the world immediately. Sometimes people ask, how can that happen? How can a person who dies, say, in New York, appear in Perth immediately? Because the mind is not located in space. That's why. In the same way, you cannot point to happiness. You cannot point to depression. But it's real. Were you imagining that happiness? Do you imagine depression? It's real. You all know that. Because it's part of the mind. The mind is. It's not in the brain. People can have no brains. It's not in the heart. You can take out your heart and have a false heart. Or have somebody else's heart, transplant. You can transplant the whole body. That's why Buddhists have no objection at all to cloning. If you want to clone me, you can go for it. But don't think that if you clone Ajahn Brahm, that you'll be able to have an Ajahn Brahm who goes to Singapore this evening, and another one who stays here for next Friday night's talk, and one who can stay in the monastery, and one who can go to Sydney, and one to Melbourne. If you clone me, the person who looked like me would be completely different in personality, knowledge, inclination, everything else. In the same way that people clone a Toyota car. It looks exactly the same, but it really depends on the driver inside the car. This is all cloning is. It's just body. You're just making another body up. Sure, it looks the same. But is that all that a person is their body? Haven't you seen identical twins? Are identical twins the same personality? Are they got the same intelligence? Have they got the same inclinations? Do they even like the same food? Usually, no. That's a clone. So sometimes I get sort of really, I'd tear my hair out if I wasn't a monk. Why are people making all this problem about cloning? If they want to go for it, go for it. It's just body, all this stem cell research. If it's going to help people, go for it. It's going to help people. What's the dogmatic, unscientific, unreligious objections to these things? Absolutely stupid as far as I'm concerned. Clone as much as you want. You're just creating more bodies, streams of consciousness to come into. Where those streams of consciousness come from, their past lives, who knows? You'll never get the person you expect. If you've got Einstein's brain, apparently there's a movie about that or something, if you get part of his DNA and you clone a new Einstein, he will look the same, but he won't be half as clever, I guarantee. Stem cell research. That's not a being there. The being hasn't come in yet. In Buddhism, they say a being descends into the mother's womb at any time from conception until birth. Sometimes it doesn't go in there at all. One of the cases of rebirth, those of you who want to look scientific evidence of rebirth, Professor Ian Stevenson, he spent his whole life putting rebirth onto a scientific basis. If it wasn't for the fact that people just do not want to believe in rebirth, he'd be a famous scientist now. His University of Virginia, he spent a couple of years as a visiting fellow of Magdalen College in Oxford. This is not just some weird professor. He's got all of the credentials. He was actually, his research was funded by the wife of the founder of Xerox. Gave him all the funding for this. I don't know if Xerox to do with reproduction or reincarnation. It's really weird, but these things do happen. But anyway, he found one case, very clear case of a person who remembered their past lives with no way of gaining that information from any other source except that that person was him in a previous life. Only that person died, his previous life died, only a few weeks before he was born. I wondered, all those other months that fetus was in the womb, who was it? As far as Buddhism is concerned, the mother can keep that fetus going, her sort of stream of consciousness. But when another stream of consciousness enters, then it becomes the new person. And that was one case where that stream of consciousness entered the mother's womb when the fetus was pretty well developed. That can happen. That's part of Buddhism 25 centuries ago. The stream of consciousness doesn't enter the mother's womb, stillborn child. Heaps of evidence about that. That's why that when a Buddhist looks through a telescope, they're not scared. They're not scared of science. Because science is an essential part of Buddhism. If science can disprove rebirth, then Buddhists should give up the idea of rebirth. If science disproves non-self and shows there is a self, then all Buddhists should abandon non-self. If science proves there's no such thing as karma, but there's a big God up in the sky, then all Buddhists should believe that. If it's provable. Buddhism has no sacred cows. However, I encourage you to do those experiments. I bet you will find out there is no one in there. You will find out karma. You will find out you've been here before, not your first life. And if you don't behave yourselves. You'll have another life to come yet. If you think you're finished with school and with nappies, do you really want to go through that again? So, be careful. So, science and Buddhism. I think that Buddhism is pure science, which doesn't stop without there, but which also includes the mind, the being, the ghost and the machine, and doesn't make any anomalies. Picks everything inside, looks at it scientifically, especially with experience, and it's incredibly successful. One of the reasons why people celebrate science is because of all of its achievements in technology. One of the reasons why Buddhism is growing these days, because of all of its achievements in the technology of the mind. How it solves problems, how it explains mental difficulties, and how it succeeds in solving those inner problems. In the same way we celebrate science because it has all these great gizmos which actually work. You try some of these Buddhist gizmos. They work. They solve your inner suffering and pain. That's why Buddhism is growing. I think that Buddhism will supplant science. Buddhism and science. Thank you very much. Okay, any questions, comments or complaints? Any scientists here? Yeah, go on. Yeah. How come the tranquilizers work on a person? I recently read an article in one of the magazines that the, not so much the tranquilizers, the Prozac. Somebody compared Prozac to placebos and found that placebos work just as well. One of the reasons why such things work is because of belief, confidence. If you're sold this amazing project, this snake oil, that it works. Why was snake oil so popular? Why do people swear by snake oil? Because it worked. Because people believed. One of the medical experiments which was done not so long ago, some doctors in the US treated people with bad knees. They had arthritis or very serious problems. They could see it on the x-rays. One of these doctors, I don't know how he got away with this, but this was reported. He put them under general anesthetic, made the incision on their knee, then immediately sewed it up again and put them back in their beds, never telling them that all they did was make a scar and sew it up afterwards. They did nothing else. But they got everyone to tell the patient that the operation was successful, and they should recover. And the patient did recover. Not once, but many times, the placebo effect. They saw the scar, they'd been through the anesthesia, and they would never believe that the doctor would just do the cut and then nothing else. And they got better. And this was actually reported, not once, but many times. How did that work? Mind and belief. Where does belief live in the mind? Faith. Why is it that whether it's a Buddhist or a Christian, if they believe so much, they actually do get cured? Don't have to be a Christian, a Buddhist happens as well. How the mind is huge. So that's what happens. A lot of those things are belief. Okay, I think that's enough for this evening. So I know there's a few scientists and psychiatrists and psychologists in here. You can come and have a go at me afterwards, but thank you. Thank you for listening to this. Again, what I said, don't believe it. Just please experiment and investigate this for yourself. So if you don't take those antidepressants and you get even worse, please do not sue the Buddhist Society.